Okay, I have a bit of a bone to pick with the financial industry today.
Oh, who are we fighting this time?
We are fighting the Rule of Thumb Brigade. You know exactly what I'm talking about. I open my email, I scroll through social media, and it's just this barrage of slogans.
Right.
One day it's the 60-40 portfolio is dead. The next, the 60-40 is the only safe haven.
It's exhausting. Then you get rebalanced quarterly, but also let your winners run.
Exactly. It feels like a really blunt instrument for a surgery that needs, a scalpel. And that's why I'm so excited about today's deep dive. We are back with Chapter 5 of The Infinite Investor.
And the author, Jocelyn Dubey, basically takes all those rules, throws them out, and says, you don't need rules, you need an operating system.
That distinction is everything. We've spent the last few sessions building out the buckets, the hardware, basically.
But hardware is useless without software. Chapter 5 is that software. It tells you what goes in, what comes out, and maybe most importantly, when to just sit still.
He calls it the lenses.
Yes. And a lens is not a rule, it's a question. The idea is that before you make any decision, buying, selling, holding, you have to run it through five of these filters.
And you have to run them simultaneously.
Yeah.
That's the part that sounds intense. We have five of them: ergodicity, duration, power law, harvesting, and behavior.
And they don't always agree. In fact, the most valuable moments are when they're in conflict. That's where the real insight is.
Okay, let's unpack the first one then. The book calls this the master lens. It has absolute veto power. Lens number one, ergodicity.
This is the big one. And the core question is deceptively simple. It's just, can I survive this decision?
We've used that word ergodicity before, but
Yeah.
here the author really gets into the math of it. He talks about the ensemble average versus the time average.
And this might be the single most important concept in the whole book, so we have to get this right. It explains why average returns are basically a lie for an individual investor.
Okay, break it down for us.
Let's use the book's example. Imagine six people playing Russian roulette for $1 million.
A bit dark, but okay, I'm with you.
The ensemble average, the average for the group, is that five out of six people walk away millionaires. That's an 83% success rate. A Wall Street analyst would call that a strong buy.
Yeah, an 83% chance at $1 million sounds pretty good on paper.
For the group, yes. But now look at the time average. That's your experience. You're the one pulling the trigger. If you hit the bullet,
Game over.
exactly. You don't get to try again. Your personal return is negative infinity. That's what the book calls an absorbing barrier. Once you hit zero, you're absorbed. You're out of the game.
So when we look at a stock and say, oh, the market averages 10% a year, we're thinking about the ensemble.
Right. The market always comes back, but you, as an individual, might not. Ergodicity forces you to ask, is there any plausible future where this decision wipes me out?
So it's not how much can I make, it's what happens if I'm spectacularly wrong.
Precisely. If a position is so big that a 40% drop ruins you financially or psychologically, that decision fails the ergodicity lens. I don't care what the expected return is.
The book uses this great imagery of the shield versus the sword.
Yeah, and most people are all one or the other. You have the shield people, all cash, terrified of risk. They survive, but inflation eats them alive.
And then you have the sword people, all leverage, big concentrated bets. They fly high until they don't.
Until they hit that absorbing barrier. So the ergodicity lens isn't about minimizing risk to zero, it's about eliminating ruin risk. You have to stay in the game long enough for compounding to work its magic.
So practically, this all comes down to position sizing, right?
100%. The book's pretty clear. If a 5% position goes to zero, it hurts, it stings, but your life doesn't change. If a 40% position goes to zero, catastrophic. Game over.
So if the answer to can I survive this is anything but a resounding yes, you just don't do it.
Nothing else matters. Veto.
Okay, so lens one keeps us alive. Let's move to lens two, duration. The question here is, when does the cash arrive?
Yeah, this is a concept borrowed from the bond world but applied to stocks. We're looking at the timeline of value.
Short duration and long duration.
Right. Short duration is cash now. Think dividends, buybacks, predictable profits. These are your bucket 3A stabilizers. Their value is anchored in today.
And long duration is cash later.
Exactly. Future growth, optionality, big promises about the future. That's your bucket 3B, the explosive growth stuff. Their value is anchored way out in the distant future.
So why is that distinction so important? Why not just buy what's going up?
Because they react totally differently to market physics, especially interest rates. Long duration assets get crushed when rates go up because the value of those far off future dollars just collapses. We saw that in 2022.
Right.
Short duration assets are less sensitive to rates, but they can be disrupted. Today's cash cow can be tomorrow's dinosaur.
So the strategy is to have your short-duration assets actually fund your long-duration bets.
That's the key. The boring dividend stocks generate cash, and you use that cash to take flyers on the risky moonshots. The portfolio becomes self-financing. It's a beautiful system.
But then the book talks about what it calls the holy grail, these dual-duration companies.
Yes. This is my favorite concept in the chapter. These are the companies that do the bucket strategy inside their own business.
Like Alphabet.
Alphabet is the perfect example. Google Search and YouTube.
Yeah.
That is a massive short-duration cash machine. It just prints money. 247.
Billions of dollars.
But they don't just hand all that cash to shareholders.
No, they plow it back into the business.
They redeploy it. They take that short-duration cash and pour it into long-duration moonshots. Waymo, DeepMind, quantum computing.
So by owning one share of Google, you're hiring a capital allocator to run this strategy for you.
Exactly. It's an internal compounding machine. And because it's their own cash, they don't really care if interest rates go up. They're immune to that duration risk that kills other growth companies.
Same with Amazon, right? AWS and ads are the short duration engine funding the long duration logistics and AI.
And Berkshire Hathaway is the original. The insurance float funds the equity portfolio. It's a powerful model. If you can find them, they are incredibly robust.
I love that. Okay, lens three, power law. The question, am I exposed to the asymmetric winners?
This takes us back to that Bessem Binder reality we've talked about. The frankly terrifying fact that only 4% of stocks create all of the market's net wealth.
It's a wild statistic.
Yeah.
It means 96% of stocks are basically ballast. They don't really move the needle.
Which means the market doesn't follow a bell curve where the average matters. It follows a power law where the extremes are all that matter.
So if you miss that 4%, you miss everything.
Your returns will probably trail a simple treasury bill. You're taking on all this risk for nothing.
But here's the 100-bagger paradox, as the book calls it. We know we need to own these huge winners, but it is impossible to know which ones they'll be ahead of time.
That is the catch-22. Before the fact, a future 100-bagger looks identical to a crazy speculation that's going to zero. So the parallel lens forces you to be humble. You have to admit you can't perfectly predict the future.
So how do you solve it? If I can't pick them, how do I own them?
You build a system that catches them by default. That's why Bucket 2, the index, is so important. It's the dragnet. It guarantees you own the winners because you own everything.
And then you have Bucket 4, the amplifiers.
Right. Small, deliberate bets on that right tail. And that sizing connects right back to our first lens.
To ergodicity.
Absolutely. The positions have to be small enough that if they go to zero, you survive. But they have to be big enough that if one of them really takes off, it actually matters to your net worth.
Okay, lens four. This is the one that's a real mind bender for me. Harvesting. The question is, should I convert paper wealth to real wealth?
This is all about fragile versus anti-fragile. Paper wealth, the number on your brokerage screen, is fragile. It can disappear. Real wealth, cash in the bank, a paid off mortgage that's locked in, it's anti-fragile.
I get that in theory, but here's my issue. The book says to sell winners to harvest the gains, but selling triggers taxes. And I've been trained my whole life to avoid taxes. Why would I volunteer to give the government 20% of my win?
And that is the natural reaction. We see the visible tax, the capital gains tax, and we hate it. But what we ignore is the invisible tax.
Volatility tax.
The volatility tax. Let's get the math. You have $100. It drops 50%. You're at 50.
Yep.
Now it goes up 50%. Are you back at 100?
No. 50 plus 50% is 75. I'm still down.
That missing $25, that is the volatility tax. Negative compounding destroys wealth way faster than positive compounding builds it. Volatility itself has a cost over time.
Wow. Okay. I never really thought about it in those terms.
So when the book calls for a tax reframe, it's saying, stop thinking of capital gains as a penalty. Think of it as an insurance premium. You're paying 20% to lock in the gain and insure it against going back to where you started.
So the choice isn't tax or no tax. It's which tax do you want to pay? The visible one to the government or the invisible one to the market's volatility?
Exactly. And there's a connection here to Claude Shannon, the father of information theory. He proved mathematically that if you systematically rebalance a volatile asset, sell a little when it's up, buy a little when it's down, you can generate returns from the volatility itself.
Wait, even if the stock ends up going nowhere?
Even if it goes nowhere, you're extracting energy from the waves. But if you just ride the waves, you just get seasick. Harvesting is a core part of the compounding engine.
That's a huge mindset shift. Okay, final lens, lens five, behavior, the meta filter.
This one is different. It's not about the asset, it's about you. The question is, does this action increase or decrease non-ergodicity? Or, to use the book's metaphor, am I about to break the vase?
The vase principle. I love that. The portfolio is the vase. It's already intact.
And most of our urges to do something, to tinker, to optimize, just risk knocking it over. Your behavior can destroy your portfolio, but it can almost never optimize it into being safer.
The book points to three big traps here: the optimization trap, the activity trap, and the narrative trap.
The optimization trap is thinking you can tweak the math to get a slightly better return, but you usually just make it more fragile. The narrative trap is telling yourself a story to justify an emotional decision.
And the activity trap is that feeling that just sitting still is lazy, like we should be doing something.
Right. We feel like if we aren't clicking buttons, we aren't investing. The book has that great Charlie Munger quote, "Sit on your ass."
It's blunt, but it's probably the best advice.
It creates a clear hierarchy. Survival first, compounding second, optimization as a distant third, if at all.
Okay, this is all great in theory. Let's use the book's example to see how it works in practice when the lenses disagree. Should I add to my Palantir position?
Perfect. This is where the magic happens.
So let's say I own Palantir. It's up 80%. I'm feeling like a genius and I want to add more. Let's run it through the lenses. Lens one, ergodicity.
Okay. If you add another 2% and it goes to zero, are you ruined? No, it stings, but you're fine. Green light from ergodicity.
Awesome. Lens two. Wait, let's use the book's order. Power law. Is this a potential asymmetric winner?
Yes, absolutely. It's a classic bucket four amplifier. It has that massive upside potential. So another green light.
Two for two. I'm buying more stock.
Not so fast. Lens three, duration.
Oh, Palantir is definitely long duration.
Mm.
Its big profits are way out in the future.
And if you already own a lot of tech stocks, you might be getting overexposed to that one factor. This lens flashes a yellow light. Caution.
Okay, yellow.
Oh.
But I still have two greens. Let's go to harvesting. Lens four.
This is a hard no, a red light. The position is up 80%. The harvesting lens says you should be trimming that position to turn fragile paper wealth into real wealth, not adding to it.
Man, you're killing my buzz here.
And now the last one, the final boss, lens five, behavior.
Right.
Why do you really want to buy more? Is it based on new fundamental analysis? Or is it because seeing that green number on the screen makes you feel smart and you want to feel even smarter?
It's mostly the feeling smart part.
That's the narrative trap. And you're about to make what the book calls a forbidden flow, moving safe, ergodic cash into a volatile asset that's already had a huge run. The behavior lens is screaming stop.
So we have two green lights, a yellow and two red. What's the final call?
The decision is do not add. In this system, the protective lenses, harvesting, and behavior almost always veto the aggressive ones. The tension between them revealed the truth. This was an emotional urge, not a logical one.
It's like having a board of directors in your head, and each one has a very specific job. It prevents you from lying to yourself.
That's the whole point. It turns investing from a game of guesswork into a process. The lenses ensure you stay in the game, balance today with tomorrow, cash the big winners, keep what you've earned, and most importantly, protect you from yourself.
It turns a pile of stocks into a compounding machine.
That's the goal.
So we have the buckets. We now have the lenses, the operating system to run them. But there is still one huge piece of the puzzle missing.
The selection.
Exactly. How do we actually find the companies to put in bucket three in the first place? What separates a true long-term compounder from just a flash in the pan?
That is the selection process, and that is a whole other deep dive.
And we will be getting to that one very soon. For today, maybe take a look at your own portfolio through these five lenses. You might be surprised by what you find. Thanks for listening to The Deep Dive.
See you next time.